The Shaq Show is a production of iHeartRadio. Twenty-five years ago, Ben Crenshaw won the 1995 Masters, and it remains one of those tournaments that we all know where we were, if we were alive, when we watched it, who we were with, everything about Ben's emotional victory the week that Harvey Pinnock died. I spoke to him today, which would have been the first round of the Masters normally. Ben would have presided over the Champions Dinner earlier in the week, as he has done since 1998, which I didn't remember, but I went back and read his wonderful book written with Melanie Hauser, A Feel for the Game, and he's been doing that since and presides over that wonderful gathering that is a great part of the Masters tradition. But without further ado, here's my conversation with Ben Crenshaw discussing 1995 and the 13th hole at Augusta National. Thank you, Ben, for joining us. I know you'd much rather be in Augusta, Georgia this week, but in lieu of that, I hope we can talk about the Masters and not get too depressed about not being there this week. How are you?
I'm fine, Jeff. It is strange. I've got to tell you that, when this thing started, I was actually at Augusta before they made all these announcements, and they were scurrying, and I just barely missed the chairman, Fred Ridley. He had flown back to Tampa, but I was invited by a Dallas member to go over there, and we played, one afternoon and then had dinner in the evening, and then we flew back the next day. But right then, it was just so strange being there, Jeff, at that time, because nobody knew what was going to happen. It was just the fear, the unknown had just barely set in. And there were like eight other members at the club, and we played and had dinner that night. But then the next day they announced, we're not going to do it. We're postponing it. And it was so strange being there. But anyway, came back, and then going through the ramifications of not only not playing the Masters, but PGA Tour stopped, all athletic events stopped, colleges, my youngest daughter is in her last semester at USC. Oh. Taking courses online.
Yeah.
They postponed the graduation. So, it's just funny. The whole nation has stopped. But I must say, in the past few days, in the last week, when the announcement was made that the tournament was going to be played in November, I think it gave a boost in the arm, certainly in the golfing world. Everybody looks forward to this time of year, starting the year and then the ensuing championships. And it's just, something's wrong when they cancel Wimbledon and the Open Championship. You just go, what is going on? So we have things to look forward to. I know that the specter of what the weather is going to bring in November, I mean, who knows? It could be cool. I just hope it's not wet, Jeff.
Yeah.
I hope for a little breeze and dry conditions. The cooler conditions might not have. You might not be able to hit the ball as far.
Hmm.
It could be really interesting.
Have you played there in November?
I just hope it plays fast. I have, and it tends to be damp sometimes in. It's long. It plays long then, but just hope that it stays dry somehow.
Do you you play the members' tees these days, I presume?
I play as far up as I can.
Yeah, you go for fun now, right? Good.
Yes, I do.
Well, on that topic, I went back and watched some moments from 1984 and 1995 when you won, and I would like to cover a little of that with you today. I know these anniversaries are different for different people, but Alan Shipnuck wrote a wonderful piece today, or that's posted up on golf.com that I'll put in the show notes about the 25th anniversary, and going back and watching with you and Julie the 95 telecast, was that the first time you'd watched it in a while?
Yeah, I have not. I had not watched it for a long time. And it's when I watch that, it's the weather that day was particularly bright and it was warm, and the ball for me was traveling a pretty good way. I'll never forget the tee ball I hit on 13 that last day.
Huge.
It went around the corner, had a 5-iron to the green. I don't think I ever, it never did, as long as I played over there, which was, good Lord, 43 times. I'd never been that far. So I hit this 5-iron at a critical juncture and pulled it, of course, over left of the green, and somehow made a 4 to keep pace. But no, the ball was traveling pretty good that day. When it gets like that, you have to change gears a little bit, and you have to worry about how far the ball's going, especially in your approach shots. Trying to get the right club and the right shot. But no, that day it was particularly bright.
Do you like that? Because Ken Venturi always felt like the golfer's ideal weather was a gentle overcast or overcast. Is Augusta significantly different in those different lights versus overcast?
Yeah, it can be, Jeff, because there's so much undulation in the ground. And when the sun starts to go down, you get glares, and you, like 15, you're always into the sun if you're playing real late. That brings up to me one of the best stories I ever heard about number 15 at Augusta. Dave Marr told me a long time ago when he was, Arnold Palmer was, this was 1964, and Dave was running second to Arnold playing with him, and they drove it out on 15, and of course Arnold had a 4-shot lead, and of course he whips out a 4-wood and he's going for the green. And he swings, and the ball got lost in the sun. And he turned around to Dave, and he said, Dave, did it make it across? And he said, hell, Arnold, your divot made it across. So, no, I mean, but you can get some glare. And, those tall trees, no, Ken Venturi's right. You can always see better on a little bit of an overcast day.
And then it mutes the contrast that you get with the shadows and the late light. So I can imagine that. But just on that day, obviously we know all what a magical week it was. You've talked a lot about the wait and how excruciating it was. How was that one that day for you compared to other, because you were in contention so many times and had that weight of teeing off late. How was that one compared to others? Did you have a different feeling, or was it similar to the others?
I just wanted to try to keep going. The thoughts that I had with my swing, my rhythm felt very good that whole week starting out on Thursday. And I played a really nice quiet round on Thursday and then kept it going on Friday. And Saturday was good, and I just did not suffer so many lapses of concentration, or I didn't get upset with myself when I made a mistake. And it was just miraculous to me that I only made 5 bogeys during the week. That's just not like me at all. I mean, but I just had patience that week, and I was not. Not in a hurry. I just had a nice pace going, and I kept it going. And, Jeff, I've said so many times that I had a lot of help from a lot of different places that week. And it just somehow I had a calming temperament going around most of the week. And I've just kept this simple thoughts going And Carl Jackson was just brilliant in the way that he handled me. He knew me so well, and he could tell the first of the week when we got the news of Harvey's death that I had a practice session, and he said, "Ben, you look like you're playing hockey. You're too fast." And just said, "Get that ball back in your stance and make a tighter turn with your shoulders." And I mean, it was in within five balls, I started hitting the ball well. And I just gained confidence just in a very short period of time. And I just kept that thought going the whole week. And I had a great feel. Some great things happened to me. But five bogeys during the week, that's remarkable to me.
Yeah. Now, you say you were calm, but watching the replay, you were pretty hard on yourself after the tee shot. Well, I don't know if you were hard on yourself on the tee shot on 12, or you were just mad that you were about a foot or two from being on the right where you wanted to be. And then 13, you were pretty hard on yourself when you pulled the iron.
Oh, I was. 12 was a pretty good tee shot, and it was just a little short.
Yeah.
And, you know, fortunately, I got it up and down.
That was a beautiful.
That calmed me down. Oof. But then I don't know, it just is preposterous that I hit the ball around the corner on 13, had a 5-iron to the green, my longest tee shot, then I messed that up. So I was a little perturbed there, but the danger was losing a stroke to the field then. And wow, that putt went in. That gave me a big lift.
And you were leaderboard watching that day, or not till the back nine?
I didn't watch it until the 15th when I crossed the pond and saw that Davis Love had posted a brilliant round. And then at that moment, I was even with Davis. So I went over to 16T and said, this may be my best chance, 16-17. And I just had when I walked over to the tee box, I started looking at the 16th shot that I had. And I said, you know, I've got just a little bit of a following wind. And the whole process through the picking of that club, it was just like it was crystal clear. Just make a good swing with a 6-iron. And no, I didn't have to do anything to it. So it was just a great relief to see that ball going up the green that start coming back to the hole.
Your rhythm that day, that was the thing I noticed watching that replay was just, and Weisskopf mentioned it. Well, actually, kind of set up like he did as an announcer. He was so good at announcing and set that up a little bit about how that was just kind of what you needed. And he was impressed with that tee shot on 13. He thought you had 4-iron in, but as you know, watching it, but he was so impressed with it. But your rhythm just looked it's as steady and just beautiful as I think you ever was in your career, right?
It was just a nice flow, and it was unhurried.
Yeah,
it was an unhurried backswing, and I got things together at the top, and I came back down. But my ball position felt great. You know, I got it in a position where I had to stay down through the shot. It was more instinctive than anything. I just, you know, all through that, when I made the birdie at 16, and then I hit two really nice shots at 17, and really made a wonderful putt there. And God, it was just such a relief to have one more stroke. And then I hit a nice tee ball at 18, and I started walking down the hill, Jeff, and I started breaking a little bit. I said, I cannot believe that is happening this particular week in these circumstances. And I started breaking. I went up the hill and hit a kind of a poor 8-iron shot. And then, you know, luckily enough, I've gotten up to where I had an extra stroke, and I got that putt in, and I just collapsed.
Yeah.
And Carl, I was asked many times, he said, well, what did Carl came up to you, and what did he say? And I remember he said, Carl was saying, are you okay, buddy? And I just mumbled out, no. And he said he did a radio interview this
last
week.
Yeah, it was great.
He said not only he was crying, he was boo-hooing. But I was totally spent. Totally spent.
Yeah, I'll put that in our show notes. It was with Scotty and Ed on the radio, and it's a great listen. It's a lot of fun. Was there anything else from watching that broadcast you noticed? I noticed the spike marks on the greens on a couple of those putts you made.
Very much so, especially that one on 13.
Oh, my Lord.
That was a bunch, and I think
it was a minefield.
Made that putt to stay, you know, to not give away another stroke, you know, then because I knew everybody was going to birdie that hole the way it was playing that day. So I didn't want to give another stroke away. And no, it was great relief when that ball went in. But no, the spike marks were there.
I have to ask one question before, and we'll take a quick break after that. But Julie, in the article that Alan wrote, was quoted having some laughs about the fashion, which is amazing. How things change. And it wasn't that long ago. I know it's 25 years ago, but it was 1995. But it is amazing. Where are you on shirt selection for the final round as it coordinates or relates to the green jacket? Is that something you ever gave thought to? Because it was an interesting choice for the final round, a blue floral pattern. I wouldn't have guessed that as green jacket friendly.
It was kind of a strange pick of colors, wasn't it? And Alan did such a great job in that story. But yeah, it was funny. I had a contract with a clothing company, Jeff Rose, and this guy came with the shirt. I could tell it was really blue, but what was really important was what was on it. And it was a montage of Bobby Jones winning. It was Grand Slam year, and I thought, well, hey, that's pretty good. I want to wear that for inspiration, and very much like the Ryder Cup shirts.
Yeah.
You know, but it was like a montage of Ryder Cups and all winning teams of the United States. And that took people by surprise. No doubt. But the color was such that the pictures and the portraits themselves stood out. So that was the reason for the color.
Huh?
But no, it didn't. It probably didn't go great with the green jacket.
Did you think about that though ever?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Some guys do, right? Quite a few do.
Yeah. But I said, I'm going to wear this because he's my inspiration anyway. Bobby Jones. So, It worked.
I got to find a close up of that shirt. I did not know that.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
Okay. Where is that shirt now?
We've got it.
Yeah. Good. Good.
We've got it here. I think Neat. Scott Sayers, my manager, has one too.
Nice.
But yeah.
Well, let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors, and then I want to talk about the 13th hole with Ben Crenshaw on The Shack Show. All right, we're back. So, Ben, you know, it's a strange time, and I think it's fun to just kind of go deep on something. And I had the pleasure of getting to spend a little time with you and with a beautiful rendering of the 13th hole by a young man named Josh Pettit, who's an aspiring architect and doing some work and a McKinsey nut and knows everything there is to know. He's the one who found the old par 3 course rendering by McKinsey that's in the Olmsted archive. And anyway, we came down to Austin for the Golf Channel and filmed you looking at that map. And I just was thinking, with everything that's going on, it'd be fun to just go through everything about the architecture of that hole and pick your brain if you're okay with that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, then let's just start at the walk from 12 to 13. Since you've first played Augusta National, the walk has gotten a little longer to that back tee. But if you don't mind, just tell me a little bit about that walk from an architect and a player's point of view, and what it's like.
I've often wondered, Jeff, when Dr. McKenzie was first building the course, I've always wondered whether the bottom of the course or the 13th hole had that singular fascination in his mind. And in its day, it was the most natural hole. It still is.
Yeah.
But it is the actual depiction of the hole. It says everything about the golf course. It says everything about what should go on in a player's mind, in that you have this water, it's a very shallow creek on the left, and the fairway tilts right to left, but it absolutely dares you into trying to play that draw off the tee. In other words, play close to the trouble, and then you have a supreme reward, and both in terms of the length that you can gain by your tee ball, and a flatter lie on the shot that you're thinking you're about to make. But it's when you look at the tee ball, you have all that room to the right. It's very, very safe over there, but it just simply lengthens the hole. And you play it another couple of times and you say, well, I know that I can get this ball around the corner if I play it correctly. But then you play it and then you crash a few times. You hit it in the creek and you say, well, you dummy, you've got all that room to the right. And then the second shot is just, the green is just beyond the tributary of Ray's Creek, and it's inviting. It's fairly wide, but you know that if you come off the ball a little bit, in other words, hit it to the right, you're cooked. You're going into the creek. And a very, very undulating green. The old green was spectacular.
You say old.
The old green, the original green.
Okay. When did
before?
Okay.
That's to say before. I'm not saying casting any aspersions on Jack Nicklaus, but the drainage swale to the left of the green was not there in
right.
the original. And it had, you know, a series of shallow bunkers back there, but the green was maybe a little wider, the different undulations. And it was almost a three-tier green. Very long, of course, but it, once again, the green and how it was built was to portray. Once again, it's risk reward. You can go for the green. You can make an eagle. You can make a quick six or seven, and it's played so much of a pivotal role in so many tournaments there. But it's the thought of taking, Jeff, a entirely natural situation, making a golf hole out of it, much as they do in the British Isles. You have a situation and you make a hole out of it, and there it is. But its brilliance is its simplicity. I suppose the way that you would put it. And yeah, let's not forget that it's maybe one of the most gorgeous holes
yeah.
that you could ever look
yep.
at when it's in bloom. It's
yeah.
just spectacular. But the contours of the ground are just beautiful. The contours are beautiful.
The fairway to me is, I try to explain to people just how severely tilted it is. Do you think they massage that much? Because it feels, it's right on the edge of almost extreme, it seems to me. The one place you get that view, it's one of my favorite spots, is over between 12 and 13, looking down 13, and you kind of get a sense of it. But Is that something that people probably underestimate in terms of how difficult it is, the severity?
Oh, absolutely. You can hit a very good tee ball out there, and now you're faced with an awkward lie. That ball's way above you. And so that denotes a hook.
Yeah.
That brings a hook into the equation, and that's not what you want to go into that green with. You'd love to have a high fade with a little spin on it, but that's a difficult shot to play from that lie. So there again, taking the terrain that they had, and they did not alter it that much. But the great part is that the closer you play to the creek, the more level lie
right.
you've got. So that's brilliant. So you know how many second shots have been tried and missed from those lies in approach. And so you get the green light, and then you've got to deal with that lie, and you've got to do a little extra something to keep your balance to hit a solid shot. So it's pretty thrilling. It's pretty thrilling. There's nothing like it when you're in contention when trying to play that shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I sense that's always one of the things that people don't quite understand when all of us want to see the whole play as it was intended, that when the players are able to throw it over the corner, they lose both the need to shape the tee shot and also the use of the fairway and the dynamics of being down low left versus up high right. And I don't know. It's I you've got to think that was one of the holes, if not the hole, when they looked at the property. And I believe they even mentioned it, Mr. Jones did, and maybe in Golf Is My Game, but that was a centerpiece of the whole routing working around that ground. Didn't one of them write that was they tried to they found it essentially?
Yes. Oh, yes. You know, and the water, they always had problems with number 12 being flooding issues. Mm. And they, you know, many, many years they had problems with number 11 as well. You know, particularly, you know, and also Clifford Roberts' book, they had drainage problems, you know, in the early years, you know, that miles and miles of tile underneath so they could try to drain the property because, you know, it consists of clay. And that drainage is always a problem when you've got clay. You've got those lower areas, water is going to collect and it can't get out sometimes. So the bottom of the course, as beautiful it is, they had problems in the beginning, but there's no telling what kind of network it underneath the turf there. No telling.
Yeah. Yeah. You got me thinking too about the green. Did you ever play a version of it where there was a more distinctive front, way, way front left hole location that you see in the old photographs?
Well, I can't remember that. I'll tell you one thing, Jeff. When I was an amateur, my first 2 years, 1972 and 73, they gave us a print of the 13th hole.
Hmm.
I've still got it, and it depicts the old green, and it's a beautiful print, really a beautiful print of how the green was. I'll tell you another thing too. If people could look up, there was a series of golf shots that Ben Hogan
right.
did. Those are kind of black and white, but they show the green, which was then, and it's beautiful green, probably a little more natural looking green, I dare to say. But it's, people could look that up and show people how it was. I've looked at that, and it's pretty interesting.
And then there were those unusual bunkers that Alistair McKenzie and his team and Wendell Miller and everyone created.
Yes.
What would you call it? Yeah. How would you describe those there?
Well, I'd probably say a little more natural looking.
Yeah.
offending anybody, but they were a little more unkempt, let's say.
Yeah.
That was just the look back then. You see it in the old pictures, but no, that's a different era.
Yeah. Now, when you did you and Carl have an understanding about that hole that you discussed in advance, or was it just a moment, a day by day situation, and he would just it would just be like any other hole that he was caddying for you on?
Oh, it was very much day by day.
Okay.
Very much day by day, and you know, I tell you what, so much fun with Carl Jackson. Carl Jackson knew me so well, but he knew the golf course so well. I mean, I was convinced that I had the best caddy, and that's why I stayed with him forever. There's no that was crystal clear in my mind. But we had a way of working out a particular club to go into a green, and we would just discuss it very simply. You know, and I'd say, "Well, Carl, I like the six." And he said, "You said you got it. We're together." And I would say something very simple, like, you know, it's a light five. I like that, but we work out shots. We never worked with yardage.
Mm.
Did you know that?
No,
we never worked with any yardage. He knew the yardage, but we were just concentrating on the shot to play.
So he wouldn't give you a number.
No,
huh?
We didn't work out any numbers.
Wow. Did you play that way anywhere else?
I did. You know, if my first full year on the tour, 1973, I'd played by absolute feel. I didn't have any yardage at all.
Well, that for a caddy, that I mean, you really have to have a trusting relationship with a caddy to do that, right?
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, this was, you know, way long ago with people. People actually, Dean Beeman and Jack Nicklaus. Jack Nicklaus got the idea of playing by yardage from Dean Beeman.
Mm.
This was way back when he was an amateur. So he started charting courses a little bit more. Arnold Palmer had a great old caddy named Creamy Carolyn on the tour who made all these books. He was one of the earliest bookmakers on tour. That, you know, and he started selling them, and then the idea proliferated. But, you know, the start of my career, not many people were using yardage.
Hmm. It's hard for us to fathom that now.
Can you imagine that?
Where they have ShotLink data and an analyst who breaks it down to tell people how to play a hole, and of course, all the numbers
dissected by it's dissected by everything now.
Well, let's take another quick break, and then I want to ask you about those 2 years and the final rounds here on the Shaq Show with Ben Crenshaw. Okay, so 1984, the moment you thought you saw Billy Joe Patton. Remind me, was that on Saturday or Sunday?
That was on Sunday.
Okay. So you didn't hit a very good drive. TV had you at 225 off the tee. That seemed a little low.
Yeah, I don't know where I caught that on the club, but I didn't get enough out of it. And I made a quick decision not to go for it on my second shot. I would have had to powder a 3-wood where I was. And so many tournaments that I played, Billy Joe Patton would always be the rules man on 13. He'd hide behind one of those trees, and I would always see him. And it's funny, I thought I saw him during that particular decision, but he said he wasn't there. But I'll tell you this, he was in my mind before I hit that shot, because I knew that in his 54 year, he went for the green on 13 and 15 and lost narrowly. But I thought of him, and I laid up, and it was strange, very strange. But I That guy was so funny. He could really tell a story, but man, he came awful close.
He
did. A couple of times. As an amateur, I tell you, the guy who really came close was Charlie Coe.
Mm.
Charlie Coe was a brilliant player. God, was he a beautiful player to watch. I once, in Austin here, we had a pro-am, you won't believe this, Jeff, in 1969, and Orville Moody had just won the U.S. Open at Champions in Houston. And we had this little Austin Pro-Am at Austin Country Club. Had some fine players that came out. And Harvey said, Ben, I want you to watch one player today who's going to be here. And that's Charlie Coe.
Hmm.
Man, was he good. He was really fun to watch. He could sting it.
Did he give you anything specific that I want you to watch, or just watch him?
Just watch. No, yeah. You just watch that. Just watch that man.
Would he ask you after? What you saw, anything like that?
Yeah, I did. I said, Harvey, what a swing. I said, he had the most beautiful wrist cock at the top of the swing. But it was natural and it was solid. Mm. It was really solid. It was fun to watch.
Back to 84, you lay up. And then what was the, you were sort of exasperated and kind of put your arms in the air and Ken Venturi didn't know what to make of it. What was that?
I was saying to myself, I had to lay up.
You were selling it. to yourself.
I had to lay up. I threw my hands up. I surrendered the shot, Jeff, is what I did.
Yeah.
Surrendered it.
Now, your dad, that wasn't one of the times you could hear him yelling out, lay up, right?
No, that was 15.
Oh, he'd only do it on 15. Okay.
Yeah.
Or he did it that day on 15.
No, he didn't do it that day, but he did it. He did it so many times I could hear him on 15. He'd lay up, lay up.
And didn't that constitute advice?
Yeah, it would.
Well, good. The committee doesn't need to go back and look at those. but he'd do it no matter what, right? It wasn't like it was inconsistent advice. It was the same thing every time, right?
Oh, he was so. My dad was. He knew something bad was going to happen all the time. But my brother, Charlie, and I would just laugh about that. He said, he's going to make an eight. He's going to make an eight or something.
You know, yeah.
He was just kind of that kind of dad. He was hilarious. He played it out on his sleeve.
Did you play there much with him, Augusta?
No, I never did. But he had a really good friend in Augusta. I'm not sure if he ever played the course, but he went around it many times.
Yeah. Yeah. Just kind of back to the design. I just wanted to ask you kind of, as it relates to your work and, the changes that have happened there over the years and the prospect of possibly another tee, although I don't believe Chairman Ridley wants to do it and will do everything in his power not to do it. But how much do you think about when you and Bill are doing a golf hole, the dynamics of something like the 12th green to the 13th tee there? Because I know I've heard you talk about the things that go through your mind on that walk to the tee, and it was really fun last year, by the way, Ben, in the Augusta National Women's Amateur, to see those women. Well, one, how they played, which was just ludicrous.
Yeah, well,
being thrown on that.
Unbelievable.
And then, but when they walked off 12, I barely had a chance to turn my head. I was talking to a few people and I look and all of a sudden they're teeing off, and you just forget the dynamic of the pacing is so different when you just.
Yes. Yes. You don't have to walk back that much, but then
you have to think,
you know, that girl just got up there and just hit two of the most beautiful shots on that hole.
It's incredible.
Oh, my. Just beautiful. Yeah, you're right. It's a situation where the tee was, you walk right off the collar of the green and you're there in, you know, like 40 steps,
yeah.
30 steps. And that's so nice. And then you're up there and you get a look around the corner. You see it all before you. And it's a continuation of the thought process, really, when you think about it.
And then it's so quiet. You're no people.
Let me tell you something. That is, it's almost an eerie feeling when you complete number 11, you go over the 12th tee, you hit and you start walking. And some of the old caddies are saying, you know, the only thing you can hear then is your heartbeat and the caddy's heartbeat and your playing partner. It's a spooky feeling, really.
Yeah. There's nothing like it, really, in tournament golf. I mean, they're occasional, but nothing on that stage of that size. Maybe I'm trying to think of Pebble. I guess the eighth tee at Pebble Beach, you're kind of by yourself at a certain point, but it's not the same type of tee shot in terms of everything
that's on
the line.
It's eerie. It's almost an eerie feeling. You can see all the people, all the spectators way up there, but it is quiet back there and it's solemn.
How much does go ahead.
No, it's just like, it's a reflection of what you've done so far during the round, or how you just messed up the 12th hole and you're mad at yourself, or you're excited that you made an occasional two or made a really up and down par that you needed. And you're just keyed up. Keyed up, but it's just totally silent.
Mm.
Amazing.
A lot of people, when they discuss the way the hole plays now versus many years ago, seize on the par and say, well, just change it to a par four. But mentally, doesn't that completely change the dynamics of it going from a five to a four?
Yes. And I mean, and I know that, you know, Fred Ridley is struggling with the fact he wants to keep it a five. You know, there's just that added element of emotion, someone coming from behind and making an eagle there or messing up the hole. There's just a lot that can happen dramatically if it stays a five. I would always fight for keeping it a five in some particular way. No question about it. I don't know what's going to happen, Jeff. They have all the space in the world to do what they want to now. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'd hate to make that decision, really. You want the players. You want all the players. When Jones talked about that momentous decision, you want to have people go through that every time they play it.
Yeah.
That's the fun of it. That's the thrill of it. That's what people want to see. That's what people want to feel of a leader or a pursuer in that position. And that's what makes the whole golf course so unique, because you're faced with decisions that you normally don't make at other times during the year. And it's in such a spectacular setting, so much that can happen. So much as that has happened in the past. You know the stories, you know the players, you know what happened, you know, in 1954. You know, you just start picking out years, 11, 12, 13, why they call it Amen Corner, that our friend Herbert Warren Wynn aptly named it.
Did you discuss that hole much with him?
Every bit I could to Herbert Warren Wynn. I found that man totally fascinating and so talented as a writer. He loved golf so much, so much. You know, he wrote about other sports, but golf really, really turned him on. But he could thread a story and make it really jump off the pages that you were reading. Because he knew everybody. He mentioned somebody. And so I met him a long time. He just knew everybody in golf, and he just loved it.
Yeah, I have a book.
He's a brilliant writer.
Yeah, I have a book of his, some non-golf writing that my mom picked up at a book sale, and I'm going to get into it. He gets into some of the Dodgers, famous Dodgers. I'm anxious to read just him on other things. What are you reading anything at the moment?
You know what? I'll tell you what I was rereading. And it's a book, it's on my desk right now. Our friend Steve Eubanks is a writer that I've met at Augusta many, many times. But he wrote this book a good while ago, but this book is called To Win and Die in Dixie.
Hmm.
And it's about one of Jones's contemporaries, and it's a true story. And it's almost like a mystery novel.
Hmm.
But this guy could play. This guy could play.
Who was it?
His name was James Douglas Edgar.
Huh.
J. Douglas Edgar. And he was on the Walker Cup with Jones, but this guy, he did the best job. It's unbelievable. They thought he might have been murdered.
Hmm.
And he goes through it. It's
wow.
Outstanding story, but that's just one. I've got stacks of books everywhere here.
Jim. Yeah.
I like to, I'm kind of a rereader. I go back and look at things. I've got the, right here is the Architectural Side of Golf by Weathered and Simpson, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
There's so many good thoughts in that book.
The writing is just incredible.
I'm like how you think of Max Beyer. Max Beyer, to me, you showed me some of his writings, and they're just brilliant.
They're intense.
Their thoughts are very intense, but makes so much sense. He talks about freedom of space, and almost like an American enjoys freedom, but that should be enjoyed on the golf course as well. And it reflected in his designs, and he wrote about what he thought and what his philosophy was so well.
He's the one figure that I wish we knew more about what he did to prepare Bobby Jones for designing Augusta National and Dr. McKenzie as well, since they were friends. But that time that Bobby Jones spent here in Southern California and playing Lakeside, Max Beyer's design, which was very linksy and featured so many of the ideas from the old course that he...
Spacious.
And undulation and being in certain locations and of certain halls. I just can only dream of the conversations they had. And the timing of that, of course, was so perfect before building Augusta National, and they were obviously friends, and Max Beyer wrote about him, but Jones never went into too much depth about that time in Southern California, what it meant for Augusta National. But I think it's safe to say it was part of his education and preparation for actually building the club.
I think no doubt. And they had that piece of land at Augusta, had that spaciousness that those thoughts about St. Andrews came in, and that philosophy. So I don't think there's any question that in Southern California those thoughts prevailed. He had to.
Well, I'll let you get to your reading. It sounds fantastic. And I thank you so much for your time today. I'm sorry you're not
welcome, Jeff.
Today you'd be enjoying the first round of the Masters. Normally, you would have had a wonderful champions dinner with Tiger Woods, returning as a former champion and hosting. But hopefully, you get that opportunity in November, and we can only
well,
and you get to
again.
Celebrate the 25th anniversary again in November.
We're going to do it again, and I can't wait to say a few words about Tiger at the dinner. He won that tournament last year with patience and diligence, and he had such a memory vault of things that have happened. He just knew how to play it, and things happened fortuitously for him, but he knew what to do, and he just executed brilliantly.
Yeah, don't you marvel? I mean, I always do it. Players like him, well, all of you, anybody who gets to that level, but somebody like him who I mean, has there ever been I don't think there's ever been an all-time great player who was so good, had so much trouble in a lot of different ways. His short game gave him fits for a while, his golf swing, and then, of course, his body. And then to go and do what he did as if none of that happened and put those the demons or the bad thoughts or the memories away and to perform like that. There's nothing comparable, is there? Maybe Mr. Hogan's issues were different.
I'm just thinking of a player of unbelievable concentration powers. You think of Hogan, you think of Nicklaus, and you think of Tiger. They have minds like steel traps.
Yeah.
They know everything that's going on.
Oh.
And they have such an awareness of where they are and what instincts and how to play. Those guys knew everything that was going on.
Yeah. He's so perceptive, Tiger. He's,
absolutely.
It's amazing.
As a player, nobody excels in that category. His mind is unbelievable. And he had the patience and the diligence to just wait them out. But he executed beautifully. All of his shots were, I'm not saying safe, but they were solid and well thought out.
Do us a favor if you get him in a relaxed mood in that champions dinner, get him to talk about the 12th hole and how he went over to the green. You as a Texan had to love that little bit of gamesmanship out there. It was totally clean and fair, but it was just a beautiful use of his presence and aura and the red shirt and the, you know, the moment I'm talking about, right?
When
his playing partners were dealing with the creek and he was over, he just had to go clean up that line a little bit and let them know he was on the other side of the creek and they weren't. And it wasn't rude. It wasn't rude. All the greats have done something like that, use their presence, right?
Well, I don't know. Once again, to me, Jeff, once again, the hole that stirs people's imagination so much happens to be the shortest hole there by a long shot. The meanest little mental, mind-boggling little hole that makes so much difference. It's just amazing, that little hole.
Just crazy. It's such a, we're going to get to watch it all over again. CBS is airing the final round on Sunday, and I can't wait to really sit with a big screen and watch kind of that whole thing play out again. Not because I enjoy watching people hit it in the creek, but just all the dynamics involved. And of course the wind was getting nasty and it was an amazing master, but your win in 1995 was pretty amazing. So I appreciate you reliving of it with
you're
us.
Welcome,
and
Jeff, great to talk to you.
Same here, Ben. Thank you so much.
You take care.
All right, you too.
All right.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ben. We could go all day long. I recorded a couple of other things afterwards that I will be putting together at some point here with some of the other comments of other guests so far here on The Shaq Show. We're 3 episodes in. I hope you're enjoying it. I hope you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And I will certainly, again, at jeffshackelford.com, put up some show notes. A lot of stuff from Ben's conversation there that I think you'll enjoy. His conversation with Alan Shipnuck that's out on golf.com, and Carl Jackson's recent radio interview with Scotty Sayers, and some other interesting things about Ben Hogan. I got to go dig up that Ben Hogan video on the 13th hole. I think it's on YouTube. We'll have to see. Anyway, as always, thank you to everybody at iHeart for your support of the show. The show's producer, Tim Parachka, show's logo creator, Aaron Atkins, and to Jeremy Eisenberg for helping to get the show off the ground, and to Scotty Sayers for lining up the phone call with Ben today on this very special anniversary week. Unfortunately, not one that Ben is getting to spend in Augusta to celebrate, but maybe in November, as we discussed on the show, it'll happen. The Shaq Show is a production of iHeartRadio. So for more podcasts from iHeart, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.